It is May 7th, 2011. This is Geek Speak. Today on the radio will be me and Miles Elam. The bandwidth for geekspeak.org is provided by GNI, gnihosting.com. Welcome to Geek Speak, bridge the gap between geeks and the rest of humanity. I'm your host, Lyle Trox. So please keep in mind the views expressed during Geek Speak are not necessarily those of KOSP. Today's theme song, Garage Mechanics, is by Craig Strawn from Cape Town, South Africa. More information available at notesfromthecape.com. In the second half of the show, we'll welcome you to join a conversation about technology. The phone number is 1-800-655-5877. But now, let's sit back and enjoy some Geek Speak news.
I wanted to just interject here for a moment.
This is Miles Elam.
I just wanted to set some record straight here. I mean, let's be clear on this. Admiral Akbar did not destroy the Death Star. A rebel pilot did. Akbar just happened to be the one who recognized the trap. This is not an Akbar victory, but a rebel victory. Don't let him distract you from the fact that he has never produced an official Mon Calamari birth certificate. That's all I had to say.
Thanks, Miles. Miles Elam is a software engineer and political junkie, clearly still upset about a long time ago in a galaxy far, far away. Miles, first news story for today.
I'm sorry for that.
It's okay. You have high emotions, I understand.
Yeah, I mean, arguing about this is the reason our star systems are so divided and can't come together to focus on killing Sith Lords instead of who knows what is a trap, you know.
First off, let's see. You know what I'll do is I'll cover something. This last week I've been extremely busy at work. I work at UCSC and we just launched an art show. It's still running today and tomorrow. It's called Permutations at the UCSC. And Miles, since you're driving me up there to get my car, I'm going to pull you through some of the exhibits. Pretty cool stuff.
I don't have time for that. I'm sorry.
Oh, man. In any case, you're welcome to go up. The information is available online at from geekspeak.org. The exhibit features a whole bunch of artists doing high-tech art. One of them, Miles, is really cool. Two of the artists, Phoenix Towes and Aaron Reed, have an iPad application, the new iPad 2s with the cameras in it, that overlay imagery onto the natural world, kind of virtual reality, kind of walking around space.
Augmented reality, yeah.
Yeah, really cool. And there's narrative aspects of it. But in any case, that's a cool thing to check out. And there's another piece that I was thinking about the geeks with, because Joe Cantrell's piece is doing a whole bunch of, it's really interesting. The artist, the person that sits in the chair, if you will, has one of those brain scanner things on the back of his head and VGA glasses and earbuds. And that data is being transferred, his brain data is being transferred into the sonic space and visual space of the room, projectors and sound being created from his brain waves. And then you get to control what kind of content you send to him. So it's a really neat piece. In any case, this is all what I'm doing at work. That's my day job. But you can find out more about it at danum.ucsd.edu/permutations if you're interested. It's up today and tomorrow, Saturday and Sunday.
Well, cool. Well, speaking of curious bits of media, some Italian researchers have discovered that, at least theoretically, it may be possible for, you know, your kid's band in the garage to play as loud as they want, but still hear when you say, "All right, need to come in and do your homework."
Okay, I mean, I'm curious.
One-way sound walls.
Oh, sweet. Is it? Wait. So what you're saying is, just like a one-way mirror at a police station, this works for sound.
Right, except for the fact with a one-way mirror, the only way that works is if one side is kept dark.
Right.
Whereas this one, it does not. It doesn't matter about the volume on one side. You know, one doesn't have to be quieter than the other, that type
of
thing.
With that metaphor, the room in question that wouldn't be producing sound in the other would be completely quiet. Of course, it wouldn't produce sound in the other. So in this situation, you can produce sound as loud as you want, and the other side of the wall.
Well, I don't know about it as loud as you want, but it would be dampening. Just like a one-way mirror, you could get close to it.
Now,
it's
is
not,
this an active thing where they just have a whole a microphone and a bunch of speakers? That are
no, it is not active. This is from the materials. This is basically...
Well, what kind of materials do this?
Well, it's how you shape them.
Okay.
So when you have like nonlinear photonics, that is an area that's been studied by physicists for quite a while. So they've been trying to see if that same the question is if that same nonlinearity can be created in acoustics.
The nonlinear photonics is the stories that are always start. The headline is Harry's invisibility cloak still it might work. That stuff, right? Basically, be able to bend light in strange ways.
Right, but it's also things like. Technology behind stealth planes.
Okay.
I mean, how do you get it so that... Because that's all radar is an electromagnet.
So this is just done in a much larger scale with waves instead of... See, that's the thing is I thought those things were based off of quantum principles of strange activity rather than in sound where you're not dealing with quantum effects at all. It's larger effects.
Unless you get to the... as you start focusing on smaller and smaller points, you start getting less into that full wave.
Right.
And start getting into more localized areas.
Molecules.
And so you're talking about a material that its structure, its texture is not on the scale of what we would think of normally. It's talking about scales that are much smaller to get those angles just right to get those materials just right.
Traditional sound dampening material is basically a giant air sponge, right? That's effectively, you can think of it as something that... rapidly vibrating air will bounce against and get muffled.
Well, right now, when we do acoustic dampening, you have...
That's two-directional.
Yeah, yeah, but you have foam rubber, and it's formed into...
Points and...
Yeah, angles. Into tetrahedrons and things like that.
The general idea is that you're causing the sound to bounce through as much of this foamy material as possible.
Right, and the wave hits the foam. The foam absorbs much of the vibration, and therefore it doesn't, allow the wave to progress.
In at Cabrillo Stage's old theater, when I was going there for school in electronics, there was a staircase near the stage where you could walk, and on the wall right there, they had this acoustic paneling, which was just a normal soft foam sound-absorbing thing, and it was kind of angled so that if you put an orchestra pit in, that was part of a reflective wall surface. But it happened to be that you'd walk right next to it in this very large volume of space, right? So the room itself had a bit of reverberance to it, but that sound wall, of course, was completely dead to any vibrations. And I recall walking one time, and it was pretty common, actually. I think I did this like 3 or 4 times. Walking by there, not thinking about it, my body would lean towards this null space of no sound. I'd like fall over and you'd bump into it. Because, of course, you're controlling your sense of space with your ears and, of course, the other mechanics in your head. But that lack of sound on one side would cause me to fall over. Interesting. Maybe I should talk to Don about that. It's a rare case, though. In any case, this stuff, though, doesn't work that way because, of course, with that sound... vibrating, restrictive stuff, either direction to some degree is going to be lessened.
Right.
So this stuff is much more weird. What do they call this material?
Oh, they have not created it yet. This is talking about theoretical. This is theoretical physics here.
Yeah,
this is not practical physics.
Well, since we're in this...
But the change is that people didn't even think that theoretically it was possible. So that's the change. That's why I thought it was noteworthy, even though you can't actually buy one-way foam for your garage right now. You will have to put up with your son's drumming at late hours just a little bit longer.
See, I always think about solving that problem with active speaker systems, right? So you put mics around the space, and then depending on the sound you get, you phase invert it and amplify it back out again to try to null it, which is the way you can theoretically do that now.
Works for a point source. Works for... For example, if you want to make sure the sound doesn't go from the garage into the main house, that would work. But it might amplify the sound if you were standing outside the garage at the street.
Right.
So like noise-canceling microphones, the only reason they work is not because they're canceling the noise for everyone, but they're canceling it at that one point source at your ear.
Right. That's when you're doing headphone-based stuff, but you can do a larger volume. It's just not as... It's uniform. Let's go on to other things. speaking of sound, though, in the brain, there is a the speech network of the brain. There's it's you know when you're making phonemes, when you're doing all this kind of creating of speech, you do it very quickly because of a whole area of the brain that does that effectively. And this there's a journal of neural engineering that talks about they have an article with this like 6, 7, 8 scientists involved. I'm not going to list them out, but we'll have it up on GeekSpeak. The basic idea is that the brain waves from thoughts of sounds, you can move a cursor with it. So when you think of the ch sound, a certain part of your brain is activating in that area. And so they put in implants, an array, if you will, covering that area. And with multiple arrays, you can actually move your cursor around just by thinking of the phonemes that you want to move. And of course, right now it's at the earlier stage, but theoretically you then you'd be able to. So it's not a speech thing, if you will. It's only thoughts of the sound that cause it, right? Pretty cool idea. Just other ways of controlling.
Didn't we see this on an episode of House?
Yeah, we do. I mean, probably. I mean, there is this kind of interfacing with the human brain. This is just another case of it. It's just that we're moving more and more forward with it. It's not like there's a practicality about it. It's much more about the science. So, I don't know. It was kind of neat.
My next story is an unfortunate one. LastPass. It's something we've talked about before on the show when we talk about what do you do about passwords where you can always go online to
the last time
like
you and
LastPass.
I did a show together actually was all about passwords.
Yes.
Yeah, and I didn't recommend LastPass. I just want to be clear.
Right. I didn't either, but
in case,
I know
people talked
people
about
have,
LastPass, yeah.
LastPass is one of those cloud services where you put a password, you have a master password and you're able to get the password for each individual site. For example, it generates a whole. You say, I want to generate a password. It creates that password, and then it encrypts that password with your single master password and saved on their servers.
Right. That's the key part, and saved on their servers.
Right.
And the idea there is that any time you want to get your password for someobscuresite.com, you go up, log into that site, put in your master password, and get any of the passwords back you need.
Right. Mm-hmm. Exactly. Unfortunately, earlier this month, they were compromised, and so some folks had got access to all of the encrypted passwords. And when I say that, I don't mean they got access to the passwords themselves. They got access to the encrypted bubble.
What do you mean encrypted bubble?
When you get a master password, when you have that master password, that will decrypt the store of passwords that you have. And so they have access to the encrypted envelope, if you will, but they don't have the ability to just go in. They would have to do a brute force attack on each one to find the information.
Find it. All right. So it's still relatively protected.
But that means that your choice of password, so our show was very much relevant, that choice of password is if you use, for example, LastPass or any of these services.
Right.
And your master password, or actually even locally, if you have it on your Mozilla browser and you change the master password to be something like password or ABCD1234.
Any of
or
those
anything,
short passwords, yeah.
Any of those predictable passwords, anything that's a dictionary word, you are at risk.
Okay, even if you're using a service like this, and which makes total sense. So our password show, if you will, still stands pretty strong.
Right. If you
strong
have
passwords for those kind of things.
Especially if you have a single password, make sure that password is good.
Right.
Like all those other passwords, like you can be all sorts of zany with all the different choices of passwords. But with a compromise like this, and this won't be the last time, I'm not saying that LastPass is doing anything wrong. In fact, I laud them for their transparency, that they said, yes, we had an exploit. Yes, people should go in and change their passwords. You know, here's what's going on. Here's the status of things. I think they've been doing a great job with regard to transparency, and that is the correct way to handle security problems.
Yep. Meaning,
I don't want to beat up on them. I just want to illustrate this more as this is a systemic problem that no matter what system you use, there's going to be some type of break in the system.
And you can assume that any of these kind of online password storing sites like LastPass, 1Password, whatever, these ones that do this kind of thing, even the ones that are local, they're going to harden their security even more, right? Because there was a vulnerability and customers got hit. So theoretically, they'll focus even more on that issue.
Right. But security is not an on or off thing.
That's right.
Security is A lot of people say, well, why don't they just make it secure? And the reason is, well, why isn't your front door secure? Well, what do you mean? It's a solid door with no glass in it, and it has a deadbolt.
Yeah, but if I get my car, I can open that door.
Yeah, couldn't I, you know, kick the door in? Couldn't I do something? Oh, well, if you have one of those bars that connects up to the floor, I forgot what they were called. That prevents the door from opening, even if you take a shotgun to the deadbolt, yeah, or to the door frame. That's still not absolute security.
Right.
So we go one step further. And all of these are adding in inconvenience. In many ways, security and convenience are at opposite ends of the same spectrum.
What are those deadbolt bar things called?
Yeah, we'll have to look that up.
In any case, if you add one of those in, every time you lock the door, you got to put that in place.
Right.
And it's kind of a pain. Yeah.
Right. So that's what it is with security. And many of these services have put the equivalent of that bar. They're doing something that is far more so than what we would ever do on our home systems, even if we had an alarm, you know, set up in our home. Like, they're doing that much more. But they probably also have more people casing the joint.
Right.
More people checking out and more people trying to break in, because there's, you know, why do people rob banks? Because that's where the money is.
Why people don't rob my bank? I don't have any money.
So that's my story.
Cool. Thank you very much. Which ones to do next? Well, you know, since we're talking about security, we can talk a little bit about the PlayStation and network hacked. And interesting, I'm sure this has been covered a lot. I don't think we've covered it on GeekSpeak, but basically, some people got access to the servers that handle the PlayStation server
network.
Data.
PlayStation Network.
PlayStation Network.
PS,
it's called. Yeah, and they're able to infiltrate. And of course, California law states that within 7 days of an intrusion like that, the company has to contact the people that got affected. And so we didn't find out this happened until 7 days, because the company told their, at least California residents, about it 7 days later. And of course, from a transparency issue, I'm glad the law's in place so that they had to do it. I think that's important. There probably should be a federal mandate. There probably should be places when you're dealing with that much user data. There probably should be
with credit card information. Let's be clear here.
Yeah, I'm talking about it with credit card information, financial responsibility. I think there should be some level of, not just you have to report this in a certain period of time. There should be some level of you have to have some kind of documentation on what you're going to do when you find an exploit, what steps are going to be taken, and have that be a clean path. Kind of like you'd have a fire exit strategy for a large building. You should have that kind of strategy in place so the corporation knows what to do, what steps to take as soon as possible when they find out a problem emerges.
And this is also
Right now, unfortunately.
Right. And this is also an important point. One of the things, like for example, LastPass, the stuff that got taken from them is encrypted data.
Right.
That they would have to go, the attacker would have to go through the next step of trying to crack each and every single one of those those master passwords. And that's a good thing, that even if you break into a site, that you have this extra work to do. And this is in conflict with many pieces of legislation that have come through both in this country and more egregiously so in some other countries. France comes to mind for me, where they want the ability to get access to someone's system, they want to have access to the passwords.
Right.
And this is for law enforcement. And law enforcement may, in fact, have a good reason for it. They may have a court order for it. But those two goals are mutually exclusive. You either have the data not be accessible.
Right.
Or you have it be vulnerable if anyone gets access to the site that wasn't authorized.
Right. And that comes down to that kind of that point of it was possible, of course, for these one password people to save that master password, if you will, LastPass, excuse me, that master password in their database, right? Because who could get access to it? Mm-hmm. And then they wouldn't have to encrypt it. And then if they did get a court order to say, we want the data of this person, they could provide it, mm-hmm. right? But doing that, of course, makes it less secure by design. It's just not good policy in some cases. Right. You can't necessarily trust all the staff, but also in a situation like this, you'd have all those texts in the clear, and then that package envelope, if you were, that was encrypted, could be easily decrypted, and a person's financial information that might be there could be removed, or the bank login information, which is just as valid. So in any case, getting back to one of the problems, of course, when the PlayStation Network got hacked, You don't really know what's going to happen, right? There's NPR's, well, maybe it's not NPR's, but I listened to About the Media, From the Media. What's the name of that podcast, man?
It's some syndicated
media
public
podcast.
Radio show.
Yeah. Awesome show, one of my favorites. And they were chatting about this story and talking about how they simplify the idea. There's white hats, black hats, and gray hats. And their description of it wasn't very good, but the idea is from like an old film noir. Or a cowboy,
the old westerns, yeah.
So the cowboy that has the white hat's the good guy, right? The cowboy with the black hat's the bad guy, and you know there's going to be a showdown at the end, right? So you can think of the black hat hackers as the people that are like really trying to steal credit card information and make money.
That's the organized crime online.
The organized crime online, exactly. And it might not be extremely organized, but this big stuff is pretty well organized. But in any case, you do something really bad, you're the black hat. A white hat person would be like a security expert, like Alex Lias, who mm-hmm. does that kind of thing. He works for a financial institution. His job all the time is to know the system really well.
So and if he finds an exploit, he contacts the company, doesn't do any public disclosure for a while.
Then there's this medium space, of course, in between. They call them gray hats, but it's kind of, and what on the media, they claim that those were troublemakers. But what I think, Miles, I think you would agree with me that it's not really that they're troublemakers. They're hackers that are going, there's a problem here.
Oh, no, they're troublemakers.
Okay.
But, you know, let's have no illusions about it. They are troublemakers. It's a question of whether or not that troublemaking is justified or not. That's where the question comes into play.
So the question is, if there's an exploit in Windows in a certain problem, right, and it could cause there could be a giant issue. You could, of course, go to the company and say, you should fix this. And the company might not do anything for months and months and months. Or you could say, here's an exploit to this. And with this, you can hack it. You can get in anybody's computer. Then that company is much more likely to fix it immediately. And that's where that gray hat starts cutting color. Do you decide to do an exploit? Do you decide to hack in? Do you decide to make an example of the problem and cause mischief, thereby highlighting it and potentially solving the problem quicker? Mm-hmm. So I can see the argument both directions on that.
Or for that matter, those researchers that find a serious exploit and tell the company, and a year later, the company still hasn't provided a patch for it, and they know that it's just a
matter of time.
Yeah, it's a window whose latch doesn't close all the way.
So the question that was raised in the story that talked about the PlayStation's network is, who was it that hacked in? Is it some organized crime that uses credit cards to actually take money from people or steal identities, whatever? Or is it just some people seeing if they could do it and then, you know, maybe make an example of it? Mm-hmm. So how do you figure it out? And you don't, of course, because most of the time you don't know who actually did it. It's so easy to be
invisible. And
they're
trying not to find out because there are laws against doing what they did.
There are laws against doing what?
Hacking into a system without
permission.
Yeah.
Even if you're a gray hat, if you will, even if you're a good guy to some degree.
Malicious. Yeah, right. Or not actively trying to do.
So this story from the 28th basically shows that, the PlayStation credit card data is trying to be sold online. So it looks like there's claims on message boards saying we've got this data. It's available. Let us know. Now, whether that's somebody bragging, that's not necessarily true. Either in any case, it's looks like it was a pseudo organized, and they're at least trying to make money off of the stolen data. Kind of depressing update, but there you go.
Sony was a bank.
Yeah, I'm more and more in the space where if I'm going to use a credit card line, I think I'm going to start getting temporary credit cards because I like the idea of saying, well, let's say I want to buy something for $20 or I want a certain fee. I'd rather that not be associated completely with all my finances. I'd rather it be a temporary thing, even if it, you know, so that if it was broken into and stolen, I don't care to some degree. I hopefully see more services that allow that to be extremely easy so that every one of these bank institutes or systems online that I'm giving my credit card to, I can give a unique credit card to each one of them and only allocate that amount of money per month to be transferred to that account, you know, from my bank.
And as a follow-up to this, Sony had a second data breach.
After that.
I didn't even know that. This was about a week ago. 25 million more user details.
Man. GeekSpeak on KOSP is supported by Chartwell School in Seaside, offering academic and recreational summer school programs. Recreational.
Good set.
Thanks, man. School programs beginning June 20th for students ages 6 to 18. Registration information online at chartwell.org. You're listening to Central Coast Public Radio, KOSP. My name is Lyle Troxell. In the air with me is Mr. Miles Elam. He's a engineer, computer engineer, and political junkie. We are taking calls with questions and comments about technology. The phone numbers, which I'll give out again in just a second after Miles' geek bit. First, let me just give you the phone number, and I'll give it to you again. 1-800-655-5877. Again, that's 1-800-655-5877. Of course, that's toll-free. Just call 1-800-655-5877. Ask us anything you'd like today, Mr. Miles Elam. Do you have a geek bit of the week?
Oh, man. I did my geek bit at the beginning.
Well, oh, it's true. It was good. You could repeat it. Let's not, though. Do I have one? Well, I'll just plug on the media. Miles and I've been doing this program for over 10 years now, and so we definitely think about the impact of media on the world and how it's presented and what's done. Of course, we're always talking about that we're not journalists. We're just talking heads to some degree. There's a bit of a, except for we don't have video, so I guess we're not talking heads, we're talking faces, mouths. In any case, so I'm interested in media topics, and On the Media, one of my favorite podcasts. I listen to it only via podcasts. I highly recommend it. Again, the phone number, if you'd like to call in with questions and comments about technology, Rick is waiting to take your calls. 1-800-655-5877. You can ask us anything you'd like today. We're totally free form, and we really can answer any question you might have. 1-800-655-5877. As the first call comes in, Mr. Elam, would you like to give us another news update?
Sure. There's a draft proposal being... Actually, I'll skip that one. That one's more boring. Let's talk about CNET getting sued over its distribution of LimeWire. For those of you who've been on the net for a while, when you want to download some software, every once in a while you'll notice you get redirected to a CNET.com site. It looks very different from sites you're expecting, and you are able to download. I've downloaded Firefox this way.
Yes.
Like it's really curious.
And there's normally a listing of applications. It's a very standard format. It has a version number, what company produced it. It's
right.
Kind of like a web page about that download.
A link back to their homepage.
Yeah.
All this stuff. Well, they were also distributing LimeWire, which is
they distribute everything through that
right.
system. It's just a one location stop. Even drivers too. You can get for old printer drivers through them and stuff. Yeah,
LimeWire, for those who are not aware, is a peer-to-peer transfer system that was popularized by the fact that it got shut down by the Department of Justice for contributing to copyright infringement. In other words, its most popular use was in peer-to-peer sharing of copyrighted songs
right.
and movies. And one of the things that was found when LimeWire was taken down was that they knew about this, they were actively encouraging it for marketing purposes, and that's what got them in trouble. CNET, on the other hand, is probably closer to what we would consider a common carrier.
Mm-hmm.
Like they're distributing software that could be used for illicit means.
Right.
And someone I've heard, I read actually someone that likened it to, why go for the middleman? Why not sue DARPA for creating the internet in the first place?
Well,
that allows
me,
us to occur.
To me, it seems kind of like attacking the people that sell briefcases because briefcases can have guns and bombs in them. It's like, doesn't...
Except that, and this is the wrinkle there, every time they have a download page for various bits of software, they have an option to have a screenshot next to it. Something that lets you know what the application looks like that you're downloading, maybe a link to reviews, stuff
I've seen
like
that.
And the screenshot for LimeWire may have included the name of a popular song.
Interesting.
So that's a wrinkle, because then it becomes your selling point.
Yeah, you're stealing stuff. But wait, who makes that image, that screenshot?
There's the question, and I don't know the answer to that. If CNET doesn't know anything about it, and it's the person who has the software to be downloaded that uploads the screenshot
and
does that update, then they might not know anything about it, in which case I think they would be, or they should fall under the common carrier.
So let me ask you this. If I go write a review on Amazon.com about an axe, okay, that I wanted to get for chopping wood. I actually do a lot of wood chopping. And so I go up and I write a review and I do the user-submitted uploaded picture. And the user-submitted uploaded picture of, like, me chopping down a door, right, with the axe. Mm-hmm. Is Amazon promoting home thievery using axes?
But chopping down a door is not a crime in and of itself.
Okay, someone else. Okay,
yeah,
so I guess
but it's not. It's not clear who that is.
Bloody.
Yeah, if it showed you committing a crime with
like
that
attacking
axe,
attacking a printer in a field, Sorry.
Well, and see, that also becomes a little fuzzy because we're talking about the real world.
All right. We're talking about something horrible, producing a crime. How about I don't want to do something that's not disgusting.
Thank you so much for restraining yourself. Now,
spray paint being used to do graffiti, clearly on a public building, okay? So I upload a picture. I go onto the Amazon site. I find spray paint they're selling. I do a review of it, and I upload a user-submitted photo that is on the spraying.
Make it a lot simpler.
What?
That you have a hardware store that's selling a brand of spray paint.
Yeah.
And the spray paint has a logo on it that is showing a popular spray paint area.
But that's exactly my point. If the company that sells the spray paint on the spray paint bottle, it's promoting, right, so that the spray paint is promoting graffiti, which is illegal if it's not your property. So that, your question is, if the hardware company is selling that, the hardware company to some degree is responsible for the graffiti. Right.
Well, that's the
a good question.
So,
and that makes sense. The spray paint company definitely is, right? Because they're promoting
that. And there's also the issue of the hardware company is making money on selling that paint.
That's right.
CNET makes money selling ads. So are they liable for the money that comes from distributing the software that was found to be?
And I guess the question I have is, if their service really is allowing anybody to make comments, like Amazon's review issue site, right? And Amazon's just selling spray paint, and they have nothing to do with graffiti. But I, as a user, upload an image about the graffiti and talk about how awesome it is, and Amazon then publishes that kind of automatically. Is Amazon then responsible? Because that's the thing with the download site. I bet you anything that those screenshots are submitted by users. Because they don't have the staff and resources to produce.
In which case, it would be beholden upon the copyright holder to issue a DCMA or DMCA takedown notice.
Yeah, I mean, I get that this application LimeWire was synonymous with copyright infringement, but it didn't have to be. It's just a peer-to-peer sharing system. I mean,
right. And there are games now that you can only get the patches through P2P.
And you gotta remember that early message boards. They were synonymous. News groups were synonymous with porn. I mean, anything with the .bin in there.
Usenet still is.
Usenet still is, right. But I mean, just because the technology is allowing for something that isn't a legal thing in our court system doesn't mean the technology itself should be attacked. And that's that gray area.
It's very much a gray area and something we're going to be sorting out for many years to come.
I think that's so true. And so why don't we go ahead and go to more tangible stories. Let's go ahead and take a call or so from some listeners. And I'm trying to find the write-up that Rick has given us so I actually know who we're talking about and to. And
right after the middle break. Line one, Richard from Salinas.
Hey, thanks, Miles. I don't have to talk about it. It's like you know how to do this or something. Hi, Richard.
Can you hear me?
Yeah, we can hear you. What's up?
I'm an IT guy who just got back. I was unemployed for a year and not in IT anymore, but I hope to get back into it. And I was wondering, I heard some people talking about the latest Microsoft Office. The latest one I knew of was Office 10, I believe.
Office 2010.
So, and they were saying that it was like completely different. And I use Office 2003, I believe. And you can kind of look at the screen and figure it out. But listening to these people talk, they made it sound like the next one past Office 10 was something totally different. And I want to get your opinion on that because one day, I could find myself trying to support it. I wonder, do I need to kind of find it somewhere and look at it?
The difference between Office 2003 and 2007, I believe, was a much bigger jump. It does have more, obviously they're adding in more features and things like that, but the visual interface, the user interface, the parts that you interact with, I think it was a bigger cognitive jump. They introduced the ribbon in Office 2007.
What's the ribbon?
Instead of having toolbars with 50,000 16 by 16 icons, right. And menus that were nested three or four levels deep, they changed to what's called the ribbon, where you click on file and a wide area that's context specific opens up through the entire width of the program and extends down about an inch on your screen. 2010 still has that ribbon.
The second question was like Vista, businesses didn't really adopt Vista. It sounds like, well, I've seen them picking up Windows 7, if it is.
Yes.
Windows 7? Do you think businesses will migrate to the Office 2010, or will they stick with the 2007?
That is a question outside the scope of my research. I don't know what the uptake is going to be on that. It's just like previous versions. It's the incentive that Microsoft gives to big companies to update their systems.
I think the biggest difference really between the... I'm not going to be able to address more than that either.
It really has to do with a lot of things. It takes advantage of cloud computing more, which means that they're doing that whole you save your documents in a single place. They're trying to stave off the Google Docs aspect. But
I mean, I think the biggest thing with the differences with is going to be the user switchover point, right? The training time for users to switch between Office, an older Office and a newer Office. And I'm, constantly address this question in my personal life with friends and family deciding what to get, and I always have bad answers to this question because it's such a feeling of what with the aesthetic feeling, what you like about it. Moving between an old version and a newer version can sometimes be a horrible experience from the learning curve, and then the newer version can be touchily slow because your hardware is a lot older. And I mean, Miles, on a Macintosh environment, I've been suggesting people to get Pages and Numbers, Apple's Word and Excel. Which is not a complete suite by any means, but I find the Office solutions from Apple to be a much better user experience than Microsoft ones.
The point you make about companies skipping Vista,
that and shouldn't going, have happened. This.
Well, yeah, Windows 7 is, I believe, more popular, has had a better reception than Vista. XP is getting very long in the tooth. And as companies buy new computers, chances are they will be buying new licenses of Office to go along with that. So I don't believe that they'll be buying Office just for its own sake, just to upgrade Office, but it may hitch a ride on new procurement from businesses with regard to computing.
Yeah. I mean, it's interesting because in the education environment that I'm in, students come in the freshman year and they normally get a laptop. And of course, with that, they only get the deals for whatever software is on it. So we see a large deployment at UCSC of the newest Office, right? Pretty quick, right? So you have the students when the new Office came out a few years ago. I guess it was when 7 came out. They all of a sudden have this file format that's hard to deal with, and it's become a technical issue for us to manage. So as long as it's not the newest of the learning curve, corporations definitely wait a couple years for things like that. So that those problems are handled by others so that they can step into it and do it smoothly.
Yeah. You do bring up a good point, which is that some companies also upgrade because they keep getting, Word documents from a newer version they can't read anymore. But that tends to be a few year lag.
Yeah.
People who are the newest version of Office tend to learn that they need to save it in an older version.
Richard,
of the final format.
Richard, we help you at all in your quest for more knowledge?
Absolutely. I enjoy the wide viewpoint. If I could ask one more question.
Yeah.
You mentioned that in the Mac environment, the Office products seem to be more usable or friendlier. I'm not really Mac or PC, in either camp. I'm an IT guy, so whatever you're using, I'm trying to make it work. And recently I've been thinking, I should buy a Mac and see for myself how this thing works in the business environment.
I think it's a really good idea because if you're supporting a network, you're supporting services, you're dealing with people, and one of your customers gets a Mac, right, or gets a Windows machine in a Mac environment, and you don't know anything about it, it's really hard to figure out the problems they're going to run into and solve them without sitting at their desk and using their machine. So I highly recommend IT people get familiar with both platforms if they're going to be in an environment that have multiples.
Yeah, which means you'd also want to get Microsoft Office for the Mac
and
iWork.
Pages and iWork, yeah. So go on, Richard.
Yeah, could you recommend a sort of a minimal Mac system?
You can spend under $700 and get a complete, pretty powerful Mac, brand new desktop, but it's called a Mac Mini.
You don't really need to get a new one, though.
No, that's the thing I was thinking.
Yeah,
just
you can get
make sure
one.
You get an Intel-based Mac. At this point, if you want to buy a Mac just to feel for it, make sure you get Intel-based, because I think all the Intel-based Macs, you can install the most recent operating system. So that's the thing you're looking for, is an Intel-based Mac. And, you know, you can find them a lot. Mac users seem to get new Macintoshes more than
I don't know if that's true, but that's okay. Yeah.
Thank you, Richard, for the call.
Thank you very much.
One other note about Office 10 is that Excel goes from 65,000 rows to 1 million rows support, which is kind of cool. Rick sent that in, I think, who answers the phones, because, of course, he's an Excel expert.
To only 1 million. That's a curious thing. 65,000 is conspicuous because that's a 16-bit unsigned integer.
Yeah.
1 million just seems an arbitrary cutoff. It's a lot larger. Don't get me wrong.
I know, it's not a binary derivative that would make sense. Sue from Santa Cruz, welcome to GeekSpeak.
Thank you, and thank you for the program.
Certainly.
I have a problem with using Eudora, and I must use it. I had it for 20 years on my job. I've got Mac OS 10 6.6.6. Everything else is running fine.
Mm-hmm.
I'm running a LaCie backup.
Right.
Hard drive.
Good.
Doesn't seem to hurt or help when I turn that off. I go into Eudora, and this is just the last couple months. It was fine for the last 20 years until now. And I can do a few things fine, and then it slows down, and it takes like 30 seconds for a touch of the
So how old is your computer that you're using right now?
It's 2006. Seven.
Okay, so anytime, just out of the blue, an application that uses a lot of data on the hard drive starts to slow way down like this, the immediate thought I have is your hard drive's having problems. And the reason for that is that in a situation where when most hardware fails, meaning like your screen, if your screen fails, you know pretty quickly it's failed, right? You can tell.
Yeah.
And if your mouse stops working, you know that it stopped working. Like a lot of the input stuff that on about your computer stops working.
The mouse is a very good analogy for that, because many times our mouse won't stop immediately. It'll do this intermittent thing where it's jump a little
skipping.
Bit.
Yeah, yeah. So when you see a performance hit on an application on your computer, all of a sudden it gets really, really slow, and you didn't do any updates or anything around that time, it's a good sign that it's a hard drive problem. And the reason is that when a hard drive actually starts to fail, sometimes it crashes and burns, just dies immediately, and your machine doesn't boot anymore. But very often what happens is it starts becoming inconsistent in its ability to read data or write data.
Far more often.
Right.
Yeah.
But the thing is, the hard drive itself has this system built in where if it tries to read something and it can't, it tries again, and it tries again, and it tries again. And eventually, it probably will succeed. But that delay you're seeing can be that I'm looking kind of space. And the thing is, it's only going to get worse from there.
Yeah, and I don't mean to terrify all the folks out there with regard to hardware, but hard drives are very much, they're not based per se on, oh, this data is right there and I'm going to get it. It's based, you're getting so small with those bits, you're getting quanta, so it's the probability that you're going to get the right data back.
It's pretty good probability.
No, and they have error correction on there, sure, that helps with it, but you have this tendency to get the right data back. And so if it doesn't get the right data back the first time, it finds us through error check and correction, it goes back and tries again.
Yeah.
Oh, and so
the
probability just decreases over time for the hard drive.
Eudora, the way it works is continually writing files to your hard drive, right? Every email message you get gets a file. Actually, I think it's like two or three files that get written. One big index file for that folder, another file that's an index for everything, your actual file. But basically, because you're doing lots of file writes like that, the files get scattered all over the hard drive. And if a new file gets written into an area that's not so good, you'll start noticing that. Or an older file goes bad and it happens to be one of those index files, you're going to start noticing it right away. And since it's so spread out like that and there's so many files associated with it, it's a perfect example of seeing a bad hard drive. Does that make sense, Miles?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So Eudora...
Actually, you shouldn't be asking me if it makes sense. I already know it.
Well, I wanted to make sure I was describing that pretty well.
To our caller, does that make sense?
Yeah, I deleted almost all of my email to see if that would help, but it didn't.
So it's interesting the way you said, I have to stay with Eudora because I've used it for so long. I totally get that. And I got to say that about 2 or 3 years ago, we switched away at work from Eudora to other places. We mostly at a Mac shop, so we switched to Apple Mail. And my boss, who's very much a geek, had used Eudora for years, and he loved it, and he did not want to move. And he finally, decided to spend the time to move and transferred all his stuff over, and he's now fully functional in Mail, and I don't think he misses Eudora. So you can do it.
But there are functions that you can't have in Mail.
Absolutely. And you know, Eudora has some great find features. It's probably the best finding featured app for mail I've seen. And I used it for years and like it a lot too. What
that's
I would recommend
right.
is...
That's why I need it. You know,
yeah,
I can't...
I would recommend assuming this is a hard drive problem and solving it like getting a new hard drive. And that's not going to be fun.
So can I mean, it's working. It's running Word Office 2008 just fine. No problem. You know, I can run two versions of Word open at the same time.
Do you have a lot of mail in Eudora?
No, I just deleted it all.
Just deleted it all. Okay. Did you purge the delete?
No.
Eudora has a recover feature, and actually those files are just hidden from you until they're actually deleted. So I don't know how to do that. I haven't used Eudora in enough time to know. But it's possible that those files are all still there still. Yeah. The other thing to do is to go ahead and make a new... Eudora saves all its settings and all its mail settings and everything in your library preferences. And it's possible you could just move that out of there and then create a new system in Eudora, if you will. Create a new account. Put in your user information again, all your settings. And then you'd have your system running again, but with a brand new spanking clean install of Eudora, basically. And then you might see if there's a speed issue or not. But I got to say that if the speed just all of a sudden stopped, it started becoming really slow and it wasn't really anything you did, and then you deleted all your mail, it might not be, it might just hide the problem from you. It might be your hard drive's failing.
Oh, can I test the hard drive by running the, what's that thing?
Yeah, you can do it. You can do a test. It's called, Disk utilities under utilities under applications. Run that and test it.
It was okay, but
yeah, it doesn't really do a low level check of the hard drive. That's a tricky situation because the hard drive is going to try to recover itself all the time.
I'm sorry, I missed. You're on a Mac.
That's right.
There's the utilities you can get. It's part of AppleCare. I don't know if you have that though. That
if you get AppleCare, you can get download. What is that thing called, Miles? You and I are
totally
doing bad on names today, huh?
I'm expired on AppleCare, so I probably have to take this into the shop and probably let them...
It wouldn't hurt.
What?
It wouldn't hurt taking it into the shop and letting them take a look at the hard drive.
And have them install the Eudora so I don't lose the mail that I've got.
Well, if you delete all your mail, you're not going to lose the mail you've got. You don't have any mail. Do you still have mail?
Well, I deleted, say, 3/4 of it.
Right.
I kept a few things.
Yeah, that's the other thing is one of those few things could be the problem.
Oh.
I mean, I highly would recommend doing a move that folder out, reinstall Eudora mail, and then import all that in. But I wouldn't do any of that until I got a new hard drive. Because your hard drive is what? It's over 5 years old. It's time to get a new one.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah, definitely. Well, and you're going to get more space, and you're going to a better performance hard drive, and your machine will actually improve in speed, even if that wasn't the problem. You're not going to hurt yourself, and you're going to spend, under $100.
Really?
That's my recommendation, except that you got to get someone to install it, so...
Yeah, and I can just have them fix the Eudora while they do that.
After you do it, it might fix Eudora right off the bat by getting a new hard drive.
Thank you so much.
Good luck.
Thank you.
That was Sue from Santa Cruz, and now we're going to Boulder Creek. John, welcome to GeekSpeak.
Hi. Was that John from Boulder?
Oh, I said John from Boulder Creek. Are you John?
Perfect. Yep.
Yeah.
Okay. A quick question. I use Outlook remotely. I think it's Outlook Exchange.
Uh-huh. For your corporation?
Yes.
Uh-huh.
And I have to type in the email addresses every single time. It doesn't have the autofill function.
Okay.
Is there any way to activate that?
Well,
I'm lazy.
Yeah. in Outlook environment where you're doing Exchange, you're actually connecting to your corporate network.
Right.
And the part of the feature of that is actually for a corporation to have an address book system
right.
that works. Now, you can create a local address book, and those should autofill for you. But
local address book. Okay.
Yes, but I don't know how to do that specifically. It sounds like you know a bit about this.
Less than I care to. Okay, so I create an address book on my end.
Yeah, and that should autofill as well. It should select which address books. I am kind of going from the dark. I'm just doing this from the understanding of how the design system works, not the experience that I haven't used Outlook since before I met Miles.
Okay. Well, I'll chat with my IT guy. Second one, real quick. I've migrated to Outlook. I was an ACT user before. I've got these ACT databases, several thousand contacts. Is there any way to get this ACT information into the Outlook?
There definitely is. ACT's a big system. Someone's going to have a migration utility.
Migration.
It's an application. You'll probably find it from CNET downloads. But if you, Miles, do you want to do a little quick ACT to search? I don't know. How to do that. ACT to Outlook conversion. I'm doing a Google search, ACT to Outlook conversion, and there is definitely apps that do this. I'll link to one from geekspeak.org for you.
You guys are amazing. Love the show. Thanks.
Take care.
Bye now.
Miles, we are out of phone calls, which is amazing, but not unexpected. We have 5 more minutes left. Get into the news story, sir.
Of course I do. Don't be ridiculous. There is a Firefox extension that is called Mafia Fire. And it's a... Basically, okay, the Department of Homeland Security, I need to back up a little bit here and do some backstory.
Okay.
Department of Homeland Security is allowed to do a domain seizure. And then they can take that domain seizure and automatically reroute DNS to go to an alternate domain. You know, that lets them know that the domain has been seized. Mafia Fire is a Firefox extension that basically negates their seizure. It doesn't allow the redirection to occur. The Department of Homeland Security, or in this case, it's ICE that's actually doing this, they went to Firefox or the Mozilla Foundation and said, hey, we want you to disable this extension. Firefox has done this in the past. For example, Microsoft was installing .NET interactivity with Firefox without the user's knowledge or, mm-hmm. or assent. Firefox had, you know, taken it out. Or if you have an older Flash version, it will disable that as part of the install, part of the check. And so they wanted the Mozilla Foundation to do the same thing for this extension.
This extension specifically, I'm sorry, I don't exactly understand what it does. It stops your system from doing a redirect from where to where?
To one of the ICE's redirection servers. It can redirect traffic from one domain to another. It's a DNS redirect.
Okay. Why does that feature exist? Why is ICE doing those kind of DNS redirects?
With a court order to say, like, this domain is doing some bad things, so we're going to...
It's that thing that we talked about where there was a fail a while ago, and a whole bunch of sites got switched over to this thing
right.
that said, your website's been taken offline.
Most, many websites are not in the U.S., so they're not under U.S. jurisdiction, so it's not like ICE can just, you know, take down a site. So many times when they want to block access, they're... merely having the DNS changed for U.S. servers.
Okay, so they basically changed all the DNS servers in the United States to say, don't go there, go here now. And so that is actually something that the browser does, and it can be ignored from a plugin?
Well, the plugin will have you look at other sources.
Gotcha. So it's kind of a patch hack around, where if you want to get to the site that talks about how to break down doors with axes, then the plugin is actually going to go, well, most people found this solution to work. It's kind of like an auto search feature, and they've redirected the content.
If it's, it can detect whether or not it's being redirected to a subnet that's being controlled by ICE.
So ICE said Microsoft or Firefox stop doing that.
Mozilla Foundation, yeah, can you block this extension? Mozilla Foundation's response to this was... multi-layered, but basically saying, have any courts determined that the extension is unlawful or illegal in any way? And if so, on what basis? And, you know.
We're running out of time, Miles. Geekspeak on KSP is supported by Cruiser Internet, now offering flexible workspace with 10 gigabits of fiber internet in their new building at 877 Cedar Street in downtown Santa Cruz. All the details are online at cruiseio.com or by calling Cruiseio at 459-6301. GeekSpeak on KSP is supported home and small business tech, providing IT support to businesses, tech support for home computers. Home and business tech specialize in protecting data and been providing data storage, recovery, and virtualization for over 10 years. HASBtech.com. This is Central Coast Public Radio KSP. We're podcasting and streaming at KSP.org. For GeekSpeak and for KSP, I'm Lyle Troxell. And Miles, thanks for joining me today. GeekSpeak is a registered service mark of Online Tonight with David Lawrence and is used with permission.